And good afternoon. Welcome to House Resources. Time is 1:35 on February 17th. Members present include Representative Seaton, Representative Olson, Representative Kawasaki, Representative Hawker, Representative Wilson, Co-Chair Sadler, and myself, Co-Chair Feige. The purpose of today's meeting is to hear a presentation from our lawyer, Mr. Don Bullock, and regarding the memorandum of understanding that the administration and TransCanada have entered into. So without further ado, Mr. Bullock.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Donald Bullock. I'm one of 13 lawyers that work up the hill and support you and trying to turn your ideas and policies into bills. I've been up there working on the tax and pipeline issues since 2006. I've been in that division since 2001. Previously, I worked for the Department of Revenue for 17 years, including being a revenue hearing examiner, applying the laws, figuring out what they mean, and applying them to factual situations that came up. I've been involved in the tax legislation since 2006, PPT, ACES, SB 21, with the responsibility I shared with Emily Nauman, who's a very competent new attorney that we have working with us. And I worked with Anagia, and I actually testified quite a bit as the bill was moving through the legislature. Calling it a formal presentation might be a bit of a stretch, because I'm here to respond to your questions primarily, and I'm not the best person to tell you exactly what the memorandum of understanding means, but what I'll do is I'll go through and point out some of the things that I've read in it. But most of what I want to focus on today is how the responsibility of the legislature fits into what's going on. And we have a GIA, that's the law now. We have the heads of agreement between the producers and the state. We have the memorandum of understanding with the GIA licensee. And the only thing that you're going to be able to vote on is the enabling legislation. So it's good to understand what the memorandum of understanding means now, what the heads of agreement stands. And since those agreements have already inked, the memorandum of understanding was dated December 12th, the heads of agreement was dated January 14th. One thing that you need to figure out is what the bounds are for the enabling legislation. That's the thing, those are the bills that you can amend, that you consider setting up the boundaries within which the administration can continue toward developing a major gas project in the state. Just briefly to start where we've been under AGEA. It's hard to believe, it seems like yesterday, but March 5th, 2007 was when the AGEA bill was introduced, an act relating to the Alaska Gas Line Inducement Act. It's pretty much sped through the legislature. The effective date after governor signed it was June 8th. July 2nd, a few days later, the state issued the request for applications. November 30th, 2007, the state received the application from Trans-Alaska Company. And the Commissioner of Revenue, Commissioner of Natural Resources, found that that was the only application that was received that complied with the requirements. May 27th, 2008, almost 6 years ago, the commissioners Tom Irwin and Pat Galvin issued the written findings and determination by the commissioners that recommending the issuance of a license under the Alaska Gas Line Inducement Act. And a bill for the legislature to approve that was introduced on June 3rd, 2008. August 27th, 2008, the governor signed HB 3001 into law. An effective date failed to pass, and it's significant it delayed the issuance of the contract. So an effective date could be an issue under the enabling legislation because there are references to when that enabling legislation will take effect. November 25th, 2008, the GIA approval took effect. December 5th, the license was issued by GIA. Between April 30th and July 30th, 2010, the licensee conducted its first binding open season. It was not until May 3rd, 2012 that we knew the unsuccessful results from that open season. There was another solicitation of interest in that was announced on July 30th, 2012, and for a solicitation of interest during the period August 31st to September 14th, 2012. That solicitation of interest was just that. It was a solicitation of interest. They weren't looking at seeking binding commitments. It wasn't like the open season. So that's where we went up to that point, the last solicitation of interest. Now, GIA is the law, and it's the law that gave the bounds for the administration to determine what the contract should look like, what the license. The license is effectively a contract. We will reimburse the expenditures in anticipation of receiving the commitments being carried out that are in 4390-130. Those are the must-haves. They were controversial and well-discussed all the time that a GIA was being considered. So now we're at a transition where, first of all, beware, AGIA is not dead yet. It's still in the picture. There are still commitments to pay ongoing expenses under AGIA in the memorandum of understanding up to a certain point. So we need to consider how AGIA is going to end, and that's probably one of the biggest issues that needs to be addressed. I'll go through and just discuss the points that I have on the memorandum of understanding. And there are parts of it that I don't completely understand, and the administration can probably clarify what it means. And when you're listening to it, consider the language. One of the things, of course, is bill drafters. We try and write the language so that you can understand it. When I was a hearing examiner, I tried to write a decision that the person that the decision was about didn't have to pay somebody else to explain it to him. So it's important that you really understand the memorandum of understanding, not only what it says, but also how the administration wishes to carry it forward. So what I'll do is I'll read through these points. There's a summary of the memorandum of understanding that goes into a little bit more detail with citations to the provisions I mentioned. And then at the end, I've got a quick PowerPoint presentation, since we're addicted to PowerPoint, as things to think about and questions to ask so that you can all become experts enough to know which button to push when you actually have the bill before you. The memorandum of understanding provides for transition from the relationship between TransCanada Alaska LLC and Flint Hills Pipelines Limited. There were both companies that acted jointly as the licensee.
Mr. Chair.
A second, Don.
Yeah.
Representative Seed.
Are you on a specific page of the presentation that we have or not?
I'm not. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to just talk about it in kind of what I thought logical order of the issues and how they thread through this.
Okay. If you note, we've been joined by Representative Tara earlier in the meeting, recently by Representative Josephson. If you'd like a seat, Representative Johnson is going to be watching from his office. So.
Flint Hills, yes. Sorry, Flint Hills is on my mind lately. I don't know why. but Flint Hills was one of the joint licensees. The TransCanada Corporate Group will continue to participate in the new Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline Project by including another affiliate of TransCanada, TransCanada Alaska Development Incorporated. and TransCanada Alaska Development Incorporated was a party to the memorandum of understanding. Under the agreement, the state must negotiate two transition agreements with TransCanada and the affiliate. It's the Alaska LNG Project Equity Option Agreement, and that relates to how the state will acquire equity ownership in the pipeline if they so choose. It would be through the interest that's actually held by the TransCanada affiliate. And the second agreement is the Alaska LNG Midstream Services Agreement. Now, I mentioned earlier that the first binding open season under AGEA was important, and what was expected during that open season was that shippers would commit to capacity in that pipeline, enter into precedent agreements, and then eventually firm transportation services agreement, which they would take and use or pay for a certain part of the capacity. What the LNG Midstream Services Agreement is, the state committing to have its gas go through that part of the pipeline, that part that the affiliate of TransCanada continues to own. So it's just like what you might expect to happen at an open season as far as commitment goes, although in this case it's not, I'm not sure about whether it be subject to FERC or it could be subject to the RCA, but the concept is that neither would apply, that this would be treated like an industrial pipeline, which a producer just gets the gas to the LNG plant and ships it to water along with outlets to the state along the way. The governor's legislation and also the memorandum of understanding addresses the state's gas and the issue of taking gas royalty in kind or in value. And the bill also proposes to allow the state to accept gas from the producers in the form of gas. So we could have a significant amount of gas. For the purposes of discussion, we'll just assume that the royalty is 12.5%. The average is probably above that on the North Slope for gas.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, just for clarification, when you said the state could take gas in lieu of, did you mean tax?
Right. Yeah, sorry.
Okay.
But also with royalty, we can either get it in dollars or in gas. And this will allow us to get it in gas so that we have gas of our own to sell and our own to ship.
Specifically, you're talking about taking royalty in kind or royalty in value, tax in kind or tax in value.
Yeah. So that's the first thing that we will do. We'll decide to take it in kind or in value, and that will be part of the negotiation between the leaseholders and the Department of Natural Resources as to how that option will work. If you remember, under AGEA, one of the incentives for somebody that would commit during the first open season was similar in that it did address the issue of when gas would be taken in kind or in value. Something that will change under the governor's legislation will be that the taxation on gas and oil is going to be separate, and on the taxation of gas, it's going to be on the gross value at the point of production, and the rate in the bill is 10.5%. Not all the gas that's produced by the producers is subject to tax. The state's royalty interest is not subject to tax. So that leaves, under the 12.5% idea, that there's 7/8 of the gas that's going to be subject to that 10.5%. So it's 10.5% of 7/8, roughly 9.2%. So if we got all the royalty in gas, assuming 1/8, and we get all the tax as gas, 9.2, that adds together to about 21.7% of the production. Now, a percentage, whatever it is, and however we figure out what it's going to be, is important because that relates to the equity ownership issue that TransCanada will have in the pipeline. So if we have 21.7%, we're going to commit to ship 21.7% in that pipeline, then that's the interest that we'll have. The other interests will be divided among the other the three major producers.
Don, can we ask you to just pull the mic a little bit closer?
Sure.
For purposes of the recording.
Right. Sorry. The thing that I don't completely have my head around is the option to participate in the equity position of TransCanada. The state is not coming in independently. But before I get to that, the pipeline's divide, the project is divided into two major parts. It's what they're calling the midstream part goes from the entry to the transmission lines from the Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson to the inlet at the LNG plant, which at this point is expected to be in Nikiski. That's called the midstream part. The LNG plant is the part that will take the gas, chill it, liquefy it, and then ship it on the ships at the marine terminal. So the memorandum of understanding addresses that midstream portion. The LNG plant, one option is for the Alaska Gasline Development Corporation to expand its powers and invest in state's ownership of that LNG facility, which may be at the same percentage as the state's gas. And that part, I'm not sure exactly where it is yet. So we're going to have gas. We're going to have somebody that, in particular, that's going to be shipping our gas for us, the TransCanada affiliate that's the equity owner. And when that, if the precedent agreement signed and the firm transportation services agreement is, it says we're going to be paying a tariff and we're going to pay some cost whether we ship gas or not, and it's just the way the tariffs work, for a period of 20 to 25 years. The initial term, contract term that's identified in the memorandum of understanding is 25 years, but it says it could go down to 20. So this is nothing new. This is what AGEA was looking at, or any gas pipeline is looking at, because of the significant costs, particularly actually in the LNG facility, that there has to be assurance of these long-term contracts to support the financing of the pipeline. And so by the state committing to ship its share of the gas in that portion of that pipeline, then there's some assurance that the owner of that interest will recover its costs and be able to finance it. Now along those lines, let's talk about alignment just briefly. Alignment gets everybody on the same track and moving forward at the same time. And the state's part of the train, you know, from you stand back and look, okay, we're going to get maybe between 20 and 25% of the gas is going to be ours. Well, to that extent, we're aligned with the producers. We're going to have gas. We're going to have to ship it. We're going to have to market it. How it's marketed, details will be worked out. But there's one thing that makes us out of alignment, and that is that we're the caboose on the train. If gas isn't produced, we don't get royalty, and there's no production that can tax under the production tax. So our alignment is there as a gas owner, except that we don't start off with having the right to the gas until it's actually produced or the tax is paid with it. So that's the summary of what I consider probably the most significant parts of the memorandum of understanding. Now, as far as the enabling legislation, you have this memorandum in front of you, and you're told that if the enabling legislation isn't acceptable to the parties, that the memorandum will go away. If the memorandum goes away, there's an issue of AGEA, which is the same now as it will be if the memorandum goes away. And that's where the discussion comes out, is how does one evolve out of AGEA? In your packet, there's three statutes that describe ending AGEA. They're 4390, 230, 240, and 440. 230 isn't so much an issue because there's no allegations that the licensee has violated the license agreement. TransCanada is a good party. They do well in the business they're in. They've stuck to the agreement, and that particular section isn't an issue. The license project is found to be uneconomic, and that's 4390-240. memorandum of understanding contemplates that if certain things are done, and they're listed in the memorandum of understanding, that the commissioners will commit to pursue the finding that the project's uneconomic, or they'll allege that it's uneconomic. And TransCanada will agree if the conditions are met. There's some question as to whether that was a statutory way to get out of a GIA, because a GIA is the law that protects the state. If it was going to be uneconomic, especially if this, let's back up and look at the uneconomic for a minute. If both the commissioners and the licensee agree that the project's uneconomic, whatever criteria they want, they just aren't going to make money at it, or they're not going to have anybody use the pipeline. That ends. The license ends. And there's a provision, 4390-240, that allows the state to pay the net amount of the expenses that the licensees paid to get the information that has been gathered during the preparation of the project. And so by paying the net amount, the state could get that information. Now, if the project is uneconomic under the memorandum of understanding, it doesn't address really what's going to happen with that information that's gathered. I'm just trying to find the magic words here. It's all the data and the things that the project has gathered along the way. And it's the same with if a project is found to be uneconomic. In that case, the state pays the damages, and we'll get the same information. What the state will get is, upon the state's request, transfer to the state or the state's designee all engineering, designs, contracts, permits, and other data related to the project that are acquired by the licensee during the term of the license upon reimbursement of the state of the net amount of expenditures incurred.
Which paragraph is that?
That's in subsection E of 4390-240.
Okay, 4390-240, subparagraph E.
Yeah, it's on page 3 of the handout that has the three statutes laid out. Authority to end the AG project in 4390. So the memorandum of understanding doesn't address the information that the state might get if it's uneconomic. There's probably an expectation, and probably a reasonable one, that if the AGEA license fades away because under the uneconomic finding, and TransCanada's affiliate continues as part of the Alaska LNG project, that that data would be incorporated. I don't know. But 4390, the other onerous way for the kind of license to end is if the state provides certain types of support to a competing pipeline. And competing pipeline means a project designed to accommodate throughput of more than 500 million cubic feet a day of North Slope gas to market. Last year, he passed HB4, which was focused on the smaller pipeline to bring gas to Alaska soon. And that was carefully written to avoid that pipeline becoming a competing pipeline. There's provisions in there that so long as there's somebody eligible to receive the inducements under AGEA, that the smaller pipeline currently proposed by AGDC wouldn't become a competing natural gas pipeline. So it was carefully written. Now, if AGEA goes away, you always have the option of looking at somebody else to carry the state's interest forward. Under the memorandum of understanding, it would be a TransCanada affiliate, and the equity interest would be acquired by buying into that limited partner that's going to hold the percentage in the project that's equal to the state's gas that's going to go through that project. But there are other options, and AGDC is one option. AGDC was part of the discussion in developing the heads-of agreement with the producers as well as the Trans-Alaska Development Incorporated. So there's some options. So I mean, that's something for the legislature to continue if you want. And also along those lines, look at the period of time that the state will be committing to ship the gas, 20 to 25 years, and the interest that the state would have in that pipeline, and as well as the ability to come up with the money to pay the tariff. I watched the presentation the other day by Janik and Nikos, and it's a long-term commitment under the Firm Transportation Services Agreement. There's going to be have to issues with appropriations. I can only kind of guess what that would be. It's probably going to be program receipts from the sale of the gas that would pay for the tariff. But that's something to really consider, and that's the state's long-term financial obligation.
Maybe a question, Representative Seaton.
Thank you. You talked earlier about the states agreeing to ship the gas for 20, 25 years. Now, is that on the same condition as the producer's ship or pay? I mean, could we divert an amount of gas if we were willing to pay, or is that a firm commitment that we're making that they're not?
We're going to, through the chair, we're going to have to pay something because there are certain costs that have to be paid regardless of whether the gas is going through it or not. And this is in, which is Exhibit C to the Memorandum of Understanding. And Exhibit C incorporates the kind of provisions that relate to the state's relationship with the TransCanada affiliates that's going to be operate the pipeline. I'm just trying to find the tariffs. On page 2 of Exhibit C, it talks about the toll structure. And firstly, I'd recommend that you try and find somebody who can really tell you about tolls, what goes into them, and what the costs would be. And it's called a toll rather than a tariff, probably because it's not subject to regulation at this point, but it's what you have to pay to ship the gas. The first part is the reservation rate. This is on page 2. A fixed charge expressed in dollars per million BTU a month that will be designed to capture depreciation, recovery, return on equity, cost of debt, income taxes, fixed operations and maintenance costs, property taxes, and other non-income related taxes. These are going to be fixed costs that have to be paid whether gas is going through or not. In addition to that reservation rate, there's a usage rate, and that's a variable charge expressed in dollars per million BTU, and that is designed to capture the variable operation and maintenance costs of the gas line. So if there's gas, we'll be subject to both elements of the toll. If there's not gas going through in any particular time, then there's the reservation rate.
Excuse me, Don. Question, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So on page 2, you're talking about item number 2.
No, page 2, it's item number 6, key processing and transportation commercial terms.
And then under 6,
yeah, there's
number
2. Yeah,
2
down there, yeah.
Okay, we're talking about the same thing. Thank you.
And for members of the committee, we're in Exhibit C of the MOU. And on page 2 of that Exhibit C. Representative Seaton?
Thank you. And I just wanted to clarify, you had mentioned that the state was committing to ship the gas through the midstream. And previously we've been looking at pay or play, play or pay or
yeah,
ship or pay or whatever you want to call them. I'm just wanting to figure out whether the state is making a commitment to ship its gas, and that, let's say we wanted to have a third of our gas go over to Donlin Creek or someplace else so that it wasn't coming down through. Does that mean that we've made a commitment to ship and we couldn't just pay the differential toll charge, and then that the only ones that could supply that other use in Alaska would be the producers?
I think that's going to be subject to negotiation between the producers. I mean, when I think about the limited capacity of the pipeline, I think about Alaska Airlines flying from Seattle up to Anchorage and stopping in Southeast. If you sell a seat to Ketchikan, you can't sell that seat from Seattle to Anchorage. So to the extent that not all the gas goes all the way to the LNG facility and can spare the cost, there might be a disproportionate tariff to the outlet points on along the pipeline. But, I mean, that's just an example of trying to figure out how to cost that. But the state can sell its gas to who it wants. It's just what's it going to cost if it comes out in Fairbanks? What's the tariff going to be?
Follow-up, Representative.
Yeah, I just, from your first statement, I just wanted to make clear that we were in exactly the same position as the other parties, and part of our gas could go to other places, and we weren't in the MOU committing to have the gas go for 20 years, our proportion of the gas, through the midstream to the LNG. So,
yeah, the initial contract term is going to be the term that's required to pay for the facility. So there'll be a cost estimates, and they'll all figured, and that's how the toll charge will be figured out. And so whatever the tolls are for short shipping, that's got to be factored in and considered to pay for the project as a whole. Along tariff zones, there are three tariff zones that are recognized in the agreement. These are on page 5, below number 17, in-state gas uses. There'll be continue to be a 5 in-state offtake points for non-LNG consumption. The three tariff zones are for the North Slope to Nenana, deliveries to Big Lake, and deliveries to the LNG plant for LNG exports. So those are the different toll zones and they call them tariff zones here, on which there'll be a calculation of what it costs to ship to those points. Once the gas is flowing, the state has gas and the producers have gas, I think we're equal from the standpoint is that we have a quantity of gas to sell. I don't know how many of you went to the gas symposium in Anchorage in August, but also when the testimony that you've heard about Black and Veatch, it talks about the various risks that are involved with state participation. And that is that we have gas and we're going to have to sell the gas. And there's agreements, and it's mentioned in the heads-up agreement, that the producers will negotiate with the state to sell the gas on our behalf. But there's a risk that we don't have the flexibility that another producer might take, thinking about we have to pay some part of the toll if we don't have gas to ship. If we have a contract for that gas, we may be scrambling or even having to buy gas to make our commitments. Black and Veatch's report cautions about that when they talked about the various risks that are involved. So the optimism has to be tempered a little bit. All these projects are, you identify the reward that you're working toward, you identify the risks, and then you identify the extent to which you can mitigate those risks and get the rewards.
And Representative Salary, your question?
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Bullock, obviously you know the documents well. You studied them. I've read some of your documents as well. And I would appreciate if you give me some context of your points. It's a vast ocean of these agreements. There's many details. I'm not sure if you're talking about them in a general sense, if you're highlighting problematic areas, if you're doing a walkthrough. It's a trackless ocean. Any guide points you can give us and the people watching and listening might be very, very helpful.
Well, I'm doing a little bit of both. I'm specifically referring to the documents. But on that, I'm mostly concentrating on the issues that these agreements raise, because you don't have the opportunity to amend these agreements. If you have the opportunity to look at the enabling legislation and decide whether that legislation is giving a framework within which the state can negotiate for this pipeline to go forward. So if there are particular issues you're concerned with in this overview, then you need to talk to the administration about what the language is, where it is, and how they intend to use it.
So what you're talking about is additional boundaries that we may want in the future to add to enabling legislation?
Right. You know, for example, right now the Memorandum of Understanding has affiliate of TransCanada owning the interest that the state will buy into. This has not gone to a competitive process, and the competitive process might be delayed, but still consider whether this is the best deal the state's going to get. So if you amended the enabling legislation to say that it's not the affiliate, which is pretty much what the memorandum of understanding is based on, this would probably go away. So you need to consider what effect is that going to have on AGEA, and how long will there be any significant delays in trying to figure out who else might be interested. Mm-hmm. Now, along the lines of who else might be interested, there are things we don't know, and I'll talk about this a little bit more at the end. We've had a failed open season. TransCanada has been in talk with the producers all along. We don't know how the producers in TransCanada necessarily get along, whether they are, for example, the partner that they would choose. The producers are going to have at least three-quarters interest in the pipeline. They have their own pipelines and their own energy experience. We also have to consider whether TransCanada's interest in the pipeline project in British Columbia to Prince Rupert would be a factor into whether we could get their full attention, or whether their involvement in a competing project might, you know, how are they going to protect themselves that way? I mean, that's a young project. And actually, it was interesting that British Columbia is in pretty much the same position of Alaska as far as what our timing is, and also what it's going to take to grab part of the market. TransCanada is following an aggressive timeline when it comes to development of its Prince Rupert gas transmission project. And the company vice president said time is certainly of the essence. Growing demand in Asia, particularly in China, means huge new volumes of LNG will be needed. Now, TransCanada is a pipeline company. This is what they do. It's not a problem here, but it's something you might wish to consider. And also, when you're looking at competing gas line projects, we have an advantage over British Columbia, for example. Their gas fields aren't developed. Our fields are pretty much ready if it was the right time. Things are there on the North Slope to produce gas. So we're closer in that respect. We have a disadvantage that their pipeline is going to be 460 miles, as ours is going to be 800. So when we look at who the competition is, we have to look at what it costs to get the gas from the field onto the LNG tanker, and just make sure what the estimates are there.
Question, Representative Kawasaki.
Thanks. It actually had to do with an issue that was brought up about amending House Bill 277 and whether that is a possibility at all.
Well, you're the legislature. You know, you write the laws. it's repercussions from the amendment. So, for example, if you were to amend the legislation to require similar terms in the contract that overlapped with the commitments in AGEA, you know, that the participants may decide that that's too much of a change, but that's the type of amendment that isn't as harmful as saying, as precluding a participant in the memorandum of understanding from participating.
I guess. Well, you know, the way I see the MOU and the HOA and then House Bill 277, which is the legislation that it looks like it's either a take it or leave it scenario. Is that how you would see it? And I understand in the Article 4 of the MOU there's written notice that any of the parties can basically they can say that the enabling legislation is not acceptable and void this MOU. Mm-hmm.
That's correct. Any party can say no. But they also have the option of looking at the legislation and deciding whether if the enabling legislation is different than it was introduced, whether they can still work with it. They have that option to continue. So that's why it's important that somehow you get the guidance from the parties to the agreement, that they can provide you information of what's open to change and what's not. So that's some of the big thing is who's going to how's the state's interest going to be handled, who's going to do it, whether the state should get involved directly or through somebody else, like in the memorandum of understanding.
Okay, thanks.
Good.
And Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like you to go back and refine for us your statement about where the caboose on the train, and just give us the parameters of how that goes into effect, and then what are we, through this process, remaining committed to, even if we are the caboose and there's nothing ahead of us.
Yeah, there are certain cost recovery provisions for TransCanada in this agreement. I don't completely understand how they go. Unfortunately, this is just one of the things that I have my hands in, as you may know. But coming back to the caboose part, well, you know, you've heard a lot about it's our gas. Well, only part of it's our gas. As the sovereign, we're in an interesting position. We own the resource when it's in the ground. We issue leases for somebody else to take the gas out of the ground. We're not in the gas business. Just like down in the lower 48, the farmer doesn't want to develop the gas under his own land. It's his. They can get mineral rights down there. So we need somebody else to produce the gas for us and turn it into money. The producers enter into lease agreements, and our compensation for entering the lease agreements is we get our share of the gas. That's our gas. That's the royalty gas. And that's the part that is constitutionally required to be paid to us. And the other thing that we have as sovereign is we need money to run government. Argument whether that's a good or bad thing, but it's a necessary thing. And production taxes pay for the cost of government. It's similar to an occupation tax. If you're producing oil and gas, then you pay the tax on producing oil and gas. But we don't get anything unless there's production. So even though we may have this, say, 21.7% interest in the gas, we don't get that until it's coming out of the ground. And that's why the three engines of the train are the three major producers. And they have to all agree for this project to go forward. And the fourth partner in this, the limited liability partner, or limited liability company that would be holding it, doesn't have a gas. That would be the only interest that's not directly owning gas, because they're going to be shipping the state's gas, not TransCanada's own. So in that respect, it separates us from the other companies, the producers. So that's where our interest diverges. They can decide to sell gas, and their decision determines whether we're going to get gas or money for the gas. So we're aligned in ownership percentages once it's produced, but until it's produced, money in the gas in the ground is like money in the bank, hopefully.
Representative Stadler. I'm not sure if this is right. I don't want to interrupt your presentation, but there's a question that I would like to ask you as an attorney to help me understand what the structure would be of the, let's see, TransCanada's subsidiary would be the general partner in a limited liability corporation or a limited partnership in which the state would own, you know, all that structure interlacing. If you can help me as an amateur understand what that is and how that would work.
Well, a limited liability company has characteristics that are similar to a corporation, in which the limited liability partners are kind of like shareholders. They're not actively involved in operation of the business. So the general partner will be an affiliate of TransCanada under this, and it says it'll have a minimum interest in the project, which is about 1% or less. Now,
pardon me for interrupting you. It would have an ownership in what? The entire project?
In the entire project. Now, the percentages of ownership of this limited partnership are a critical element of this memorandum of understanding, because there's a limit in how much of this partnership the state can buy. Because TransCanada, under this agreement, wants to keep a minimum of 14% interest in the project as a whole. So what would be available to the state is the difference between that floor amount of 14% that TransCanada wants to keep and the percentage of the ownership that reflects the percentage of state gas that's going to go through this pipeline. So if it's 21.7, this maximum state interest under this agreement would be, what, 7.2? It's the difference between whatever our share is and the 14%. Now, I don't know whether the 1% that they're attributing to the general partner is part of the 14% or whether that reduces the margin that the state will get above 14 or 15%.
Follow up?
Actually, thank you. I always have a better time understanding the proportionate shares if I imagine the entire pipeline and, for argument's sake, divide up into four quartiles, whether it's, you know, plus or minus 1 or 2% based on whatever. So 1, 2, 3 producers have their three-quarter share. There is a 25% quarter share left over for the state of Alaska. And you're saying that TransCanada's arrangement under the MOU expresses TransCanada's desire to maintain 14% of the entire pipe? Or 14%?
Yeah, the project as a whole, the Alaska LNG project.
So that would represent what portion of Alaska's quarter? That 14% of the entire project would be what percentage of Alaska's quarter? In
Well, if it could, you know, go to the same percentage of 14%. I mean, that's...
So 14% of that quarter, of that 14?
Well, let's approach it from a different direction, and I can understand what you're asking is. This, under the gas lease, you know, Pipeline Leasing Act, the general requirement is that pipelines that are built across state land have to be common carriers, so that you may ship your gas in, but if you're Exxon, some of your gas is going to go through Conoco's part, some of it's going to go through BP's part. It's a common carrier. You don't have assigned seats on the airplane. Your passengers get on and they're spread out. Last year, the possibility of a contract carrier was introduced in the Alaska Gasline Development Corporation changes in HB4, which would allow parties to break out of the common carrier, and by entering into contract would be guaranteed a certain part of the transportation capacity without being the risk of getting bumped by some new gas producer. And that's the disadvantage of a common carrier is that you're open to all shippers. This is a third approach in that this pipeline is just like a pipeline from a field to the dock. Only in this case, the dock's 800 miles away. So it's been characterized as an industrial pipeline. So not that much different, probably. I'm stretching here just for the transmission lines from the wells to the gas treatment and the gas processing facility. It's just part of this whole structure for a producer to get their own gas to market. So they have a definite percentage. Man, this is you've heard in the past in different presentations about the gas, that the ideal situation for a producer is to have the same percentage of ownership in a pipeline as they have in the resource, so that they have some comfort in knowing that if they produce their share, that they're going to have a way to ship it to market and turn it into money. Okay.
Well and good. So pipe, 0.25%. 14% of the entire pipe, 14% of the quarter.
It's 14% of the entire pipe. It's the whole Alaska LNG project.
Okay. So that leaves the remaining portion for Alaska to have would be...
between, if you look at whatever percentage of the state's gas is going through the pipeline, you have all the total production. If all the gas that's produced on the North Slope is produced and the state gets its, the example, 12.5% royalty and 9.2% of that 7/8 of the producers have as gas, we're going to have 21.7%. So 21.7 is the interest of the total project, and the state can buy that fraction of the 21.7% that's above 14%. So in rounder numbers, if our share was 22% of total gas production, our pipeline share would be 22%. If TransCanada keeps 14%, we can buy into at 8% of the total project. I mean, that's hopefully the administration will correct me if I'm off track. So it's now one of the nice things I'm thinking about this, I'm thinking out loud, is you saw scenarios that, depending on the market conditions or the transportation costs, that the wellhead value of gas might be very small or nothing in the worst scenarios. In 1986, oil prices were rock bottom. And when I was working in the Department of Revenue, we're speculating as to whether an integrated company could continue to produce oil at below wellhead value. And in some cases, they probably could, because that's not their only source of revenue. Because under the pipeline tariffs, they're entitled to a certain rate of return. The tariff's going to provide for that. There's rate of return on shippings, and if you're refining, there's some profit to be made there, and if you're retailing or wholesaling. So there's different points where you can recover your costs.
Excuse me, Don, before we go down that trail, Representative Hawker had a question from before.
And thank you. Yeah, I would appreciate the opportunity. Thank you. Mm-hmm. You know, Don, I'm going to piggyback off the questions that were, you know, you'd reached here, because I think to me it's something very relevant, and I'm still trying to get my head around it from the standpoint of, is it the right thing to do? What you're talking, these percentage, you know, the 14% minimum ownership that at the end of the day TransCanada is insistent upon retaining, it's their floor, and then the 1% general partner business, you know, those are provisions 2 and 3 of the equity options term sheet, which puts them right up front in priority of, you know, what we're looking at here.
Mm-hmm.
I want to make one thing just real clear, that the 14% is equity participation interest in the midstream component. We're not talking about that
LNG
above or that
plant.
Below the midstream.
Right. Yeah, that's correct. The midstream component is from the transmission lines from Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson down to the inlet to the LNG plant.
Right. So,
for example, if we had 14% interest in there, then of whatever our interest is, then there's a possibility that under a different mechanism, the state would acquire ownership interest in the LNG plant. And that's was complicated or contemplated in the heads-up agreement, that AGDC or some other party might have a representation for the state in that project.
I might continue.
Mm-hmm.
I guess, and that's part of my notation here, is that in order to preserve that linear alignment in the entire value chain, one has to be very cognizant of that percentage occurring throughout, arguably necessitates preserving that percentage throughout the value chain. But Don, as you've looked at this and put your head to it with your background in the Department of Revenue, have you identified anything magic about that 14% number from your perspective? Is there any magic hurdle or magic benchmark that provides, or is that just, you know, somebody's business decision that that's what they're willing to work with?
I'm not aware of any particular reason for it. It's just TransCanada is a pipeline company, and that 14% will be a factor if the gas is flowing. I think it's probably what they look at as the interest that will keep them interested, and that as long as the pipeline's operating, they'll get a share of any money that it might generate.
Just, and Don, if I might.
You may.
The language in here is so definitive about this. And I mean, it says it like 3 different times all in that one paragraph, and it ends up with must not be less than 14%. The question in my head is, there's got to be a reason for this. I mean, it's something that is so definitive. And I'll be honest, I'm just trying to identify it.
I think where points are that strongly put in the memorandum of understanding, those are red flags for the enabling legislation. Now, for example, coming back to AGEA, we committed, you know, required commitments in certain things. And one of the things that would be related to a commitment is the state would be able to buy all of its interest of this partnership. If the state were to go out and consider other people that may participate or represent the state in the Alaska LNG project, that would be a negotiating factor depending on what the interest of the state was to acquire a percentage of ownership. That would be a variable. The way it's presented in here, is kind of a flag that says, don't do anything in the legislation that would reduce, you know, say this, say the legislation said the state would work toward 20% ownership. That would cut out the 14%.
Chair, it's a little bit more than a flag. It's kind of, but if I could move
it does,
on.
It does have our interest.
Right? There's flags and then some almost guns to the head.
If I could move on to a question on paragraph 3. And it's just kind of, it's an observation again on, you know, the corporate structuring. I mean, you talked briefly to Representative Sadler about the 1% general partner interest. But isn't that, in the, and when you look at that carefully at that equity option term sheet, item 3, that general partner provision is really just a management provision where, is it not, and it says right there, you know, it is to allow one partner who will have preferential voting rights in the management and affairs of the entity that ends up owning this piece of the project. As it says, you know, the general partner for that 1%, they would make all decisions on behalf of the limited partnership with a couple of caveats there. So I mean, doesn't that really just exist as a, the only thing profound about that is that it's handing all the control, even though we may own 40% equity in that portion of the project, all the daily operating control and everything else that would typically be associated with a 40% ownership in any kind of entity is being, we're recognizing that it, our equity does not come with that control. That control is being vested with a general partner who is belonged, who is owned 100% by TransCanada, and they get to make all the decisions.
That's correct, and the managing part would have the responsibility for, the general partner will be have the responsibility for actually doing the work of the limited liability company. Now, along those lines, there's another red flag in this, and it arises partly because of the delay between when the AGEA license was issued and when we knew that the open season had failed. And on page 3 of Exhibit B, in number 8, it says the parties acknowledge the confidentiality provisions of the Alaska LNG project agreements to which a limited partner may become a party, may prohibit or restrict disclosure of project information to the state. The parties agree to use reasonable efforts to allow for disclosure to the state, including on a restricted basis as required under applicable Alaska law. So because we don't have a direct interest in the ownership, that if we're effectively buying into this limited liability company, there's certain information that we would not have access to.
And just for clarification, we're talking about page 3 of Exhibit B to the MOU. I see committee members wandering through the notebooks there.
But I mentioned there was part of this I don't really understand, and it has to do with this option for the state to enter in. It seems like it's a two-step process. At some point, the state will say, yeah, we want to have the option to buy in into that partnership. But I'm not clear as to when we would actually exercise the option. So it's an option to get an option, and then the second step is when the option is actually exercised and the state actually becomes part owner of that partnership.
Representative Sadler, your question?
Thank you, Mr. Bullock. I want to probe you a little bit on the composition of the limited liability partnership. I just want to find out three questions, actually. Who would be the partners in the limited liability partnership? There would be one.
Under this memorandum of understanding, I'm not sure. I'm not sure that by buying into the limited liability partner, that's the TransCanada affiliate, whether we're just combining interest with them or we're becoming a separate limited partner. Now, the memorandum of understanding may say that, but I'm not sure exactly how that works, whether you would have limited partner Alaska, limited partner TransCanada affiliate, general partner TransCanada affiliate. I don't know.
I don't know. So you're not saying it so, but it could be that there's a Save Alaska, TransCanada as a general partner, and then TransCanada's affiliate, TransCanada Alaska Incorporated, as another.
Yeah, two limited partners and one general partner, or one limited partner, one general partner, of which Alaska's part of the limited partner. I don't know.
Okay. Don't know what the I'll try and figure out based on what you told me earlier about what the shares would be. I won't do that in the record here. But and because I don't know business, though, so a general partner is necessarily has the authority to speak for the other partners, or is it specifically just laid out in this agreement language that would give them that power?
Limited partners are more like investors. Mm-hmm. The general partner is like the executive officer that's going to run the business. The risk in that type of business structure are different depending whether you're a general or limited partner.
Good.
All right.
So far.
See, no other questions? On down the road.
Well, I don't have a lot of time to do PowerPoint, but I have some things on the PowerPoint presentation of just things to think about as you go forward. First thing, looking at the partners that of the memorandum of understanding, there's somebody that's not there, and there's somebody new there. The somebody that's not there is Exxon, that was working with TransCanada as the licensee on the Alaska Pipeline project. That they may not be there because they're more directly involved with the heads-up agreement. The other, the new party here is Trans-Alaska Development Incorporated, that was participating in the heads-up agreement with the producers, but was not previously part of the AGEA project. So this is a question, again, that I asked earlier. Given the memorandum of understanding, what changes can be made to the enabling legislation without causing the MOU to fail? So the other red flags that you might see, like the specific 14% interest or the specific partner or other provisions in this memorandum of understanding, look at the provision that raises a red flag to you. Consider if you like it or don't like it. And if you don't like it and you want to amend the bill to change the criteria that the administration negotiates under, then consider whether it's going to make the memorandum of understanding go away. I'm your lawyer for the legislative branch. It's important for the separation of powers you to distinguish what the legislature does from what the executive does. You legislate, they execute.
On this slide.
Representative Hawker.
And thank you. On this slide, Don, and I think I can connect the dots in my head on this one. Working from your conclusion back, we get one vote on the enabling legislation, and then it kind of shoots this whole thing off into the administration to go complete it, exercise the equity option agreement, and go forward. I raised this question earlier in this committee, and that is this truly an option agreement? And that is, there's no money in order that the administration and nowhere, and I believe in the legislation or otherwise, being provided with the money to exercise the option agreement. So I think they've got to come back on it for a second bite at the apple and get another vote, which would actually be an appropriations vote, in order to successfully exercise that option agreement, which, you know, obviously the provisions are the earlier of December 31, 2015, or the date of the commercial agreements for commencement of feed. Which, again, from a practical standpoint, it would certainly seem to me to throw a level of risk, doubt, and uncertainty into giving the administration the commitment to proceed.
If you look at the Memorandum of Understanding on page 5, this is the definition section where the terms are all laid out. It's kind of interesting reading, too. But it defines the enabling legislation, and the governor's bill does, HB 277 gives the authority to the commissioners to negotiate and enter into the transition agreements. The transition agreements are the option agreement to acquire equity interest and then to the precedent agreement and firm transportation services agreement.
Excuse me, Don, just to clarify, we're on page 5 of the actual MOU, not in the exhibits.
Yes.
So, and it's a whole list of definitions.
So authorize giving the commissioner authority to enter into the transition agreements that are described in the MOU. Secondly, authorize the commissioners to negotiate entering into commercial arrangements with the ANS producers for the Alaska LNG project. And the appropriation provision that Representative Hawker referred to is the third part of the enabling legislation. And I don't know whether this is in the governor's bill or what the approach they're going to take. It'll be a fiscal note to the governor's bills. I'm not sure. But there has to be a bill that will fund the state's contingent and direct payment obligations of the costs under the precedent agreement.
Mr. Chair, it just seems like a gap in the documentation as we've got it currently, including the bill and the MOU.
This relates to another part of the MOU that's kind of confusing. If you turn to page 7 in the Memorandum of Understanding, under Article 4, termination and reimbursement, it says when the MOU shall commence on the effective date hereof and shall terminate upon the earliest of these 7 things. The first one, execution and delivery of all the transition agreements. Everything just goes along. If it terminates under the next section, 4.2, if it terminates for B through G, there's going to be money changing hands from the state to TransCanada. And right now, like I say, G is still in effect. There's an agreement that the state will continue to pay costs, reimbursement costs, after December 31st, 2013. So this ongoing cost potential liability is a red flag to think about, not only from the standpoint as to whether the MOU is going to go because the enabling legislation passes or not, but also from the standpoint is if the Memorandum of Understanding fails, what happens to AGEA? AGEA has not been terminated. AGEA will only be terminated under the terms of the MOU if the MOU is in effect. And this liability for cost, development cost reimbursement, survives the MOU specifically at the end of that section. So.
You're just following on, and I think we developed with Mr. Pawlowski in our previous meeting that there is nothing truly definitive about the state exiting AGEA. It's a pretty soft provision, and we were invited to keep that in mind as we went forward and developed the enabling legislation. Right now, under the MOU, it only says that we're... Pardon me, sir, for taking a second to get to this. It says the commissioners will initiate the process of making a determination, but it doesn't talk at all about concluding that process or, in fact, making it happen, which it caused me a little trouble because it seemed to be very, very open-ended. There was no mandatory exit from AGEA, but we do have that should we approach TransCanada with that, they've agreed not to, will agree that the licensed project is uneconomic with the meaning of 4390-240A, but we still really don't have an affirmative obligation to exit AGEA in the MOU.
Yes, through the chair, we're looking at page 3 of the Memorandum of Understanding. These are recitals 11 and 12.
Right.
If you look at 4390-240, that's the agreement that says the GEO will end if the project's found to be uneconomic. And the way that statute is set up is if TransCanada, as the licensee and the state, agree that it's uneconomic, we both walk away. And there's no specific guidance for the state or for TransCanada to decide it's uneconomic. they can look at their own, it's a business decision for them. There's just not enough money, or it's not going to happen, or we're going down the wrong path. Any of those probably would be good enough reasons. But if the state and TransCanada disagree, whether TransCanada thinks it's uneconomic and we're insisting that they go forward, or vice versa, then it goes to an arbitration panel. And if the arbitration panel finds that it's uneconomic, there are specific grounds that must be made, certain facts that must be found to support that kind of conclusion. And those are a little bit more black and white, a little clear, because in that case you're having a third party make the call as to whether the project's uneconomic or not. So if you look at the memorandum of understanding, these provisions do kind of partly what the abandonment provision does, the uneconomic. They say that the commissioners will make a decision when after the enabling legislation becomes effective and execution of the commercial agreements are in place. These are all conditions precedent to this. Committing the ANS producers to initiate the pre-feed phase of the Alaska LNG project. The commissioners will initiate the process of making a determination for purposes of AS 4390-240A, and that's the allegation that the project's uneconomic. There's always different ways to write things, and depends on who's writing it. These recitals don't refer to the other way of getting out, other than, you know, not counting the licensee not living up to its terms, and that's competing pipeline, and that's not mentioned in this agreement. There's no agreement that if the MOU fails, the TransCanada would not seek to recover treble damages by alleging that the Alaska support for the LNG project is support for competing pipeline. I mean, that's an issue that will continue. Mm. It could be that this is a very amenable and friendly agreement that says, rather than litigate, we will welcome you to a part of this next project. I don't know. I mean, that's obviously TransCanada has been working on this pipeline project in the state now for probably longer than AGEA was in existence. They know more than most companies would know about working in the state. But it's an issue as to why their involvement is characterized in the terms of these recitals.
Representative Wilson, do you have a question? Or clarification?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now, kind of just walk me through it as if it was something else, so that so that I understand exactly using this terminology, so that I understand what really happens, because I'm not absolutely positive. You're saying that there's nothing in here that says what will happen if we just walk away, and so kind of put it in a little bit different words or something. So I don't know what. I just don't quite get it, I guess.
Let's say we don't have a memorandum of understanding. We're looking at the AGEA project right now. There's the issue is the project, well, first of all, what is the AGEA project? Because that's not clear. that's discussed in the memorandum that you have in your record that I wrote last year, and they have part of HB4. So let's assume that it's the Alberta project that's the AGEA license project, and that's the project that would have gone to the Alaska-BC border and go through Canada. And that was the project that was pitched in the application and approved by the legislature. Looking at that, and is that still a good business option? Well, actually, without finding that that project is uneconomic, the findings and the project plan amendments have said, doesn't look like that project's going anywhere, but we're going to do this other project. So if we're really doing this other project, we can kind of forget about the uneconomic part of the original one, which is fine in some ways. But AGEA is a law, and the AGEA as a law have specific ways to end the AGEA license. You know, sometimes you can enter into a contract, and both parties say, geez, you know, this isn't working for me. Would you be open to change it? Yeah, you know, we're in business. We have a good working relationship. So in a general contract environment, you can make those kind of changes. If you're a government agency in procurement, there's certain changes you can't make. For example, can you make a change after you've entered into a contract that would have been more favorable, that if the time you did your procurement, there would have been five other people that were interested? You know, at some point, the change is too great. In the concept of AGEA, AGEA set particularly bounds for the AGEA licensee, all the commitments in 43-90-130. The safety of the state to say, we're not going to continue to fund a project that isn't showing value. And so, regardless of the contract, there's two ways. Legislature can always review the appropriations and decide, you know, evaluate the project there. The responsibility for defining that the project as uneconomic is placed with the commissioners. So consistent with AGEA and the duty on the commissioners to consider the economics of the project along the way, this recital 11 is consistent with AGEA because it says, keep looking at it. If at some point it doesn't look like it's going to go, it's uneconomic, then this raises the issue. And then after that, it's an issue how you're going to handle it. In this case, it says that the licensee is committed that if all the conditions precedent, the things that have to happen before the commissioners can commit to allege the project's uneconomic are in place, then TransCanada will say, okay, yeah, we agree, it's uneconomic as well. This is kind of based on the AGEA provision. But it doesn't address whether the state will buy the information that TransCanada has paid for by paying them their net costs. So it's silent on that. But it probably covers most of the spirit of the abandonment project of provision.
Follow-up,
Representative.
So what we really should do, maybe we shouldn't, depending, but we could say something like, if all that doesn't work, because right now it looks like we'd end up paying quite a bit to get that information. I mean, we'd have to pay a lot of money, but we don't know if we'd get the data. Is that
right?
What you're saying?
I mean, that's another whole game, but. Remember what the state's paying for. First of all, it's only talking about qualified expenditures. And those qualified expenditures were pinned down in the inducement provisions. I think they're 43-90-110. That says that the licensee, when they pitch the application, they can get up to 50% reimbursement up to open season, and then 90% after open season. And so after open season, of the qualified expenditures. Now, TransCanada is going to have other costs on qualified expenditures, but they're paying 10%, we're paying 90% of the qualified expenditures after open season, and before that, we're paying 50%. So it's not all the qualified expenditures, it's just the money that TransCanada has put out.
So short term, I think we had, but the unreimbursed qualified expenditures are about $130 million of TransCanada's.
I've heard that figure. I don't think there's been a report on the status of the projects since last January, but I might have missed it.
If revenue can come back to us sometime with a firm number, that'd be helpful. And so let me characterize, if I can. So you're saying that, first I want to try an opinion on, are you saying, a legal opinion, that the AK LNG project is not a proper legal descendant of the AGEA process, that the AGEA has not been extinguished in the AKLNG project?
What I'm saying there, because of the way AGEA is written, and AGEA is still active, we still have a licensee, we're still paying reimbursements on qualified expenditures, it raises the issue of the extent to which the state is promoting this parallel pipeline. And, you know, a certain amount of protection is probably there because the license, an affiliate of the licensee as part of this new project. But when everybody's in agreement, things go along fine. When something breaks, that's when you don't want to be standing next to the fan.
Well, in terms of the logic tree, because excessive ventilation. So again, as my reading of this memorandum of understanding and the heads of the MOU, is that it provides a way for both the State of Alaska and TransCanada to kind of slide on past Aegea. In my favorite metaphor, you're not going to let go of the trapeze hand that's holding on this trapeze of Aegea until you're firmly grasping the next trapeze that holds on to the enabling agreement, et cetera, forward.
I think that's the reasonable reading of the situation, is that TransCanada, as the licensee, continues to have an interest in the pipeline project. Remember, Aegea wasn't to build a pipeline. Mm-hmm. It was to work toward a pipeline. So the issue of who would actually own part of that project would continue out there. So in a way, this memorandum of understanding covers that, because it allows TransCanada to continue to be involved. And this actually clarifies more than Aegea did as to what ownership interest TransCanada would have in the ultimate project.
So as our attorney, I'm not sure if you're advising us that we should clarify the extinguishment of Aegea, or we should proceed with the MOU and get past the whole Aegea question. Or, as I think I hear you saying, as our attorney, you're advising us to be cautious and cognizant of all the elements at play in this decision as we make the decision.
It's partly the last one, be cautious. But remember the slide about executive power versus legislative power. Mm-hmm. The legislature cannot find that the project was uneconomic. The legislature cannot find that the licensed assurances have been violated. Those are executive branch functions. And consistent with the executive branch function is through this recital, number 11, that requires the commissioners to move forward on the uneconomic aspect after all these other conditions have been met.
I'd like to indulge in a slightly rhetorical question.
Indulge away.
you have been the legislature's attorney on oil and gas matters for a long time. You've got a tremendous amount of experience and perspective. Has there been a more complicated deal presented to the legislature in your experience?
No, but usually it wouldn't. And the reason is that you can have complicated laws, but the laws are, you're setting the boundaries within which the executive operates. Normally, I mean, come back to something simple like procurement. We have a procurement code. Tell state agencies what you have to do. Go out, certain situations need competition, and it's not a big deal. What makes this a big deal is that we have kind of overlapping functions with the executive branch and the legislative branch. For a while, I mean, Aegea, the approval of the license passed without two-thirds vote to have an immediate effective date. So there was not universal acceptance of the Aegea approach. The issue came up then as to whether the governor could have just gone ahead and do it anyway. And there's a possibility that that could have happened, because the legislature, by saying what all the rules are and by the administration operating within all the rules, they'd carried out their executive function. So the fact that it's contemplated that the contracts will come back to the legislature for approval, I mean, that's courtesy, and that's really nice, and it's very it's helpful. I mean, you're going to have to appropriate money anyway. You always have that hook on a project. But separation of powers, I mean, it comes off often, you know, confirmations to certain boards. You know, the governor can appoint people without legislative confirmation if they're not head of an agency or have an adjudicative function. And yet in the past, sometimes under the cohesiveness and recognize we're all in the same boat, sometimes the governor will offer to do things that if the governor didn't want to, the person wouldn't have to do.
And one last one. Mm-hmm. Again, you're a legally trained mind. You had experience in these kind of complicated, cascading, contingent agreements.
I haven't had
it's a setup.
A backup with agreements. I mean, I've helped write, you know, clarify some of the laws as they've been gone through the legislative process, but I have not been involved in agreements like this.
Fair enough. having read your documents, you do a good job of setting up. It takes a couple passes through to make sure I understand what, how the decisions happen in what order. I'll channel my colleague to the right here. A flow chart would be a tremendous thing, and I think we've asked the department to provide that. Mm-hmm. Just all the different contingencies and moving pieces and dotted lines for not only for me and the committee, but for the public to understand a complicated transaction, just to see how the decision flows, where the contingencies are, what the implications of those decisions are, would be very, very helpful.
Mm-hmm. You kind of need a seatbelt and airbag analysis, too. I mean, everything looks like great right now. Enabling legislation passed, the memorandum of understanding, and the option agreement. Looks like they'll just, you know, click along. But what happens if they don't? How are we covered for that? And this uneconomic issue under 4390-240, that's going to continue. You got a plan for that.
Okay, Ruben, I'm seeing you had a question, then also.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, we're talking about the difference between the legislative authority and the executive powers, and I've been somewhat concerned in that we are talking about giving the executive permission to negotiate terms and terms outside of those that were specified. So I'm wondering how far those, if we pass the legislation as is, how far those go. In other words, could the, especially on oil taxes, although we've separated oil and gas tax formats in here, do you think that the that what we're considering would allow, or in fact would give legislative approval to negotiate oil tax terms in the legislation or in, to the executive?
That's an interesting question. I mean, there's two aspects of that. We've gone and had many discussions about setting tax rates by contract so the state can't change them over a period of time. Of course, I think the law is pretty clear that you can't do that, not only in our Constitution but our own experience between floods and earthquakes. We've had to have the flexibility to impose the $10 disaster tax when we needed the money. But agreements are going to be discussions in quiet rooms behind locked doors. There may be factors that affect, say, what the tax rate's going to be. But the administration and the executive branch cannot set tax rates. That's yours. The administration has flexibility to establish how royalty is going to be established and collected, because that's a contract. And those contracts are also, they must be within the statute. 3805180, which is the oil and gas leasing statute. There are provisions in there. So it depends on how you give the authority to the administration. Coming back to AGEA, there were the must-haves in 4390-130 that it required an applicant to commit to those things. The applicant could, if they didn't commit to those things, the administration didn't have the power to say, well, you know, we did most of them. We'll go with it. But the tax rates are going to be just like they are in the governor's legislation. It's proposing a new tax rate and different method of tax on gas. You don't know how it got there. It may be that 10.5% was a compromise between the state getting that percentage of the gas production on the North Slope, or it may be that 11 might not have been able to, for the project to go forward, and maybe 9% was giving too much away. It's hard to say that, because what goes into a governor's bill is negotiation and thought from their standpoint as to what's in the best interest of the state. But as the legislature, particularly in tax, you're the ones that decide which rate and how and what method of taxation, or even what we tax, is in the best interest of the state. So tax rates aren't negotiated, but you may get a bill that proposes a change in tax rates. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you think about SB 21 last year, the rates that were proposed and the change in structure was based on a lot of information that you saw presented to you, and it was their basis for selecting that method and those tax rates.
And Mr. Chairman, what I'm asking your legal opinion here is going forward through the legislation, is the legislature giving the authority to the executive to negotiate terms, additional terms, and would those in additional terms, by giving that authority, be to set in contract a tax system for oil?
The contract can't set the tax rate or the tax system, but the way it can be done is by calling it enabling legislation and setting up that this is agreement that requires certain changes to be made. I mean, the governor's bill's enabling legislation includes more than just giving the commissioners the authority to negotiate these commercial agreements. It addresses redefining the point of production for gas. It provides for taxing gas on the gross value at the point of production rather than the production tax value. So that's the way you would do it. You'd get a bill that says we want to tax a tax rate to be a certain thing, and when you're considering as a legislator whether that's the appropriate tax rate, you would look at why it's being offered. Last year it was shown to make us more competitive. This year you're going to be shown that the memorandum of understanding and heads of agreement requires a different method of taxation and the opportunity to pay the tax with gas. So
what you're saying, Mr. Bullock, is that when we, in the enabling legislation, give the authority to renegotiate royalties, I think what you're saying is we can either give them the authority to renegotiate oil royalties or not, and we should probably stick with just gas royalties.
I think the legislation that's proposed just addresses gas.
Just gas.
Now, there is an overlap between gas and oil that continues in the governor's legislation. You'll see it when you get it. But when I first heard of the proposal that the gas would be taxed on gross value, then we think, what about lease expenditures? Because lease expenditures reduce the gross value at the point of production down to the level that we're taxing. So that's a deduction. Because we're taxing on gross, the lease expenditures go somewhere, and they're actually, I believe, taken against the gross value at the point of production for oil to determine the production tax value. Mm-hmm. And you know, the cost of gas, you know, processing gas generally isn't as great as oil, but except when you get to the LNG facility, those costs are very high.
Reverend Satan, you good?
Yeah, just following up on that last. So then in that aspect, all production costs on gas get shifted to or get accounted for in oil, reducing value for oil taxation. And that's the interchange between gas and oil.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, again, because of the whole theory of PPT, ACES, and SB 21 is that when you have a field, there are so many common facilities and common costs that it is very difficult to divide them between gas and oil. When you looked at the combination of gas and oil in the progressive part of ACES, the more oil produced, I mean, more gas that produced, it diluted that average and brought the tax down, you know, the decoupling issue. But I don't think it's anywhere near the impact of mixing oil and gas values when you're just taking some of the lease expenditures and using them against the oil tax. I mean, it's an incentive for producers that have oil and gas deposits both to produce gas, which is an incentive that help would help this project along.
Okay. Representative Olson, then Tarr, then Sadler.
Don, it's always a pleasure to have you before a committee, any committee. And one of the things I value the most is you tell us what we need to hear, not necessarily what we want to hear. Having said that, and given the fact that you're in a unique perspective to observe the process and be a part of the process, do you think we're going to be done by Easter?
What year?
Easter comes every year. But if we're not done by a certain period of time, this the July 1st, 2014 date is a real trigger date in this. And if the legislation actually isn't in effect as of that date, in other words, if effective date provision, immediate effective date fails, got to get it signed 90 days before that date. Otherwise, the parties are going to look at it and decide whether it's triggered the abandonment of the MOU.
Well, you got the second half of my question. That was going to. Thanks again.
If I might, just to that point.
Just
to that point, the July 31, 2014 date does have a provision that allows it to be extended with the joint approval of the parties.
Right. They can agree to it.
So no need to go extend your leases in Juneau right away.
But, and, you know, that's one of the flexibilities. They're flexible on the date, but they're also flexible on the position, on their interpretation of whether the enabling legislation is satisfactory or not.
Okay, Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just on the timeline, so when we discussed this previously with the administration, they are suggesting this seamless transition from, you know, going into the transition agreements under AGEA that, and then going smoothly into the next steps for the feed phase in the LNG project. But in thinking of that separation of powers and how the legislature would protect themselves, if enabling legislation goes through, but then sometime following that, there's some disruption in that process, so it does not continue. You know, is there a gray area for those transition agreements with getting out of the AGEA license that could then, you know, because of action by the administrative, by the executive branch, then gives the legislature some kind of financial liability? I hope I'm asking that right.
There are liabilities in this agreement if things don't happen as expected. And when I referred earlier to the termination provisions in Section 4 of the Memorandum of Understanding, this is the one that somebody other than me would probably be in a better position to explain all these contingencies. Of these, I think there's... of these seven, there's only one termination that doesn't put the state at risk of having to make payments. And it also recognizes the fact that certain things are continuing to happen under AGEA. In 4.2 and A, mm-hmm. it even mentions net of AGEA reimbursement. Mm-hmm. So this is where some of the risk is to the state. Mm-hmm. Again, the enabling legislation gives the authority to the administration to make it work. But it'll have to be within the bounds of the legislation that you pass.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Representative Sauer.
Thank you. As I understand, Mr. Bullock, there's that 7.1% return to TransCanada on their development expenses. And I'd like some, you can't give it to, I guess, but some firmer knowledge of how much money is likely to be spent in developmental expenses. I would ask if that 7.1% is reasonable, but you're probably going to answer that everything's negotiable. It's also rather...
I'm not sure about 7.1. I'm also not sure that AFUDC stands for allowance for funds used during construction. Somebody from the administration would be in a better position to that. That was probably a negotiated percentage, something like an interest rate would be. It's just... cost plus.
Okay. And just to clarify a point you made a couple questions ago, that under this bill it would allow qualified lease expenditures for gas production to be deducted from oil income for tax purposes. Is that correct understanding?
Yeah, that's the way lease expenditures are handled in the legislation. I mean, that that could change. But again, it comes back to the issue of, can you really separate those costs?
And that's after the initial period, contract period, whatever that is.
Well, to digress in the governor's bill a minute, the provisions, the tax provisions currently have an effective date of January 1st, 2015. So on that date, the way the tax provisions are written is that the current tax rate is referred to as the tax in effect on and after January 1st, 2014 and before January 1st, 2022. So the amendment says that there's the new, that's what the bill says. It puts bounds on the application of the current tax. It adds a section that will tax oil at 35% of the production tax value, and it'll tax gross at 10.5%. And there's also a new provision that's 4355014 in the bill. And that's the provision that will allow a taxpayer to elect to produce to pay their tax in the form of gas instead of dollars. Just to get there, to be able to make that election, they have to be a taxpayer that had their leases renegotiated under the authority of the bill. So, but what that does, so starting January 1st, 2015, legislation passes with those changes, then you'll get an idea. You start negotiating with the producers how much gas, you know, you try and pin down that percentage of gas that we're going to get. And what gas are we going to get as royalty in kind rather than value? Which producers are going to be interested to make the election to pay their tax as gas? Apparently there's some heartburn that that election is irrevocable. But anyway, if the bill passed, they know what the tax is, the state can start figuring out what quantity of gas they can anticipate. That quantity, that percentage of the total production on the slope will merge with the memorandum of understanding and the ownership options discussed in here, and we'll have a better idea of the actual percentage of the project that the limited liability company would own that the state could buy into. So it's all like a chain of cockroaches in Hawaii. One thing leads to another, and they all have to happen in a certain order.
Okay. All right. On to state ownership.
This just reiterates what I talked about before. One thing I don't know from the agreement is, seems like there's two options. There's an option to pick up the option to buy in, and then there's at some point where the state actually requires the equity interest. I'm not sure how that works and what the timing is. This just restates what I said before. Equal to the percentage of North Slope gas the state may receive as royalty in kind and tax on gas that sets the ownership. Be aware of the economic impacts of an agreement to pay for the gas cost, transportation costs over this extended period of time.
And Representative Hawker, any question?
Yes. Apologies for asking more questions, but Don, you isn't there another way the state can acquire ownership, and it actually goes directly to the project, not necessarily the limited liability partnership that would holding an interest, and that's if the state did a sole risk expansion?
Right. The expansion comes up. Once the state has this percentage of ownership, the state can open its interest to other producers in the state, and if that requires expansion of the pipeline, then that's how it's going to be paid and how it's done.
I'm looking for affirmation that that actually, instead of acquiring a greater interest in the partnership with TransCanada's entity, the state of Alaska actually ends up owning a direct interest, direct equity interest in the project, in the midstream part of the project itself, if we took a sole risk expansion.
Yes.
No, I don't know the reference on that. It's off the top of my head.
Yeah.
I remember seeing that in the agreement that where it addresses expand pipeline and GPT.
Page 7, yes, Article 7.
Yeah, page 7.
Of the equity, Mr. Chairman, the equity options agreement.
In Exhibit C?
Yeah.
That's correct.
Okay. Exhibit C, page 7?
Yeah.
Excuse me, I want to rephrase what I just said. The midstream services term sheet.
Sure. I'm not sure how that works. I think the people that wrote the agreement would probably be better in better position to give you a definitive answer. I've tried to limit my comments to things I'm relatively sure about, and hopefully there'll be a rebuttal from the administration on anything that I've misstated.
And Representative Wilson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So now, if the state would have to end up, I mean, that would cost more for the state, too, because they would have to have a loop, right? They would have to, or would they have to pay for compression? That's probably what they would have to do, but that's going to be more cost to the state, so they're not going to get as much for their gas because of that, because that's an extra expense.
Again, you know, there's two different ways to expand. The first one is easier than the second one. And in some cases, the first one, which is adding compression capabilities, could actually bring down the cost because you just added the cost of the compression. You haven't paid for any new pipe. Looping, where you build another pipeline next to the one you already have, is where the costs get quite high. AGEA required a person to commit to world-end rates in which the existing shippers would help pay for the cost of the expansion to within certain bounds. And that wasn't a commitment that was really enforceable because it's up to the regulatory agencies. If you're going to have costs to adding capacity, generally those costs would be passed on to whoever's going to be shipping their gas through it.
In fact, isn't that one of the main features of this, basically the heads-up agreement and the MOU, is if there is expansion, and this is all under the heads-up agreement, but if there is an expansion, the cost of that expansion is borne by who's ever doing the expanding, and basically the original equity owners will not see an increase in their costs because they're not necessarily shipping additional gas unless they elect to basically buy into the expansion. So their future expenses are protected in that way.
That's a good observation. The common situation between HB4, which allowed for contract carriage, and this that is a different, it's kind of an industrial approach to getting gas, is that the people that have gas know they're going to have a place to put it, that they'll be able to ship it. That doesn't preclude the possibility of a producer on the North Slope negotiating with a new producer and buying their gas and, you know, buying it up there and then shipping it in. So that's another way that new gas could get into the project. But the state would have the option of taking the capacity that it has and maybe, you know, adjusting it to accept new gas in that part of the midstream project that the state owns. And similarly, on the state ownership slide, you know, the possibility that ADDC would participate in the LNG plant also is another way of this state ownership. And similarly, that new gas would have to go, if it wasn't sold in state, would go through the LNG plant too. I mean, so the state becomes part of all of it.
Okay. See, you didn't have any more. Representative Seed?
Thank you. And, you know, we keep talking about expansion, knowing we're going to find tons more gas and billions of tons more gas.
And that's a problem?
No. It's only a problem if it doesn't happen. And the scenario of having a 3.5 the pipeline and have AOGCC giving us 2.8 or something, so it's partially full, and then having commitments for that gas going elsewhere, and then something like Donlin Creek coming up and needing gas. If the other parties had commitments and we were wanting to stimulate economic development in Alaska, so we would be selling gas there, and that would not be extra gas, but would actually be reducing throughput to the LNG plant. Does that, in that kind of a scenario, would it be that the gas we would have to subtract or add on to the price of the gas, the transmission or the tariff for our capacity on the pipeline?
That would all be part of it. I mean, for example, in these proposed terms, it allows for three different tariffs depending on where it's going to be delivered. So that's going to affect the cost.
But if we didn't have the additional 25% of the gas to go down because we hadn't, AOGCC hadn't increased the available gas off the North Slope through fields, let's say where Point Thompson is doing oil or gas cycling, then we just have to make a decision whether we want to stimulate that economic development and tack on the additional capacity that we're not using going down to the LNG plant.
Well, this is where we're the caboose. Whether we get anything at all depends on whether the three producers are producing. We don't have the option. It was discussed in the terms of Point Thompson whether the state would take its royalty of the gas at the time it came out of Point Thompson and went to pressurize Prudhoe Bay. And then that the tax wouldn't be due until it came off the cap in Prudhoe Bay. I mean, that was discussed. I don't think it ultimately anything came over that. But generally, we don't get gas and we don't get tax unless there's oil or gas produced. This is why we're the caboose. We're not an engine. We can't go in and say, please start producing the 1/8 of the gas that's there. We want a royalty now. That would be difficult. And we'd probably have to pay for the costs associated with it. But it's a shiny caboose. When it comes out of the ground, we're going to get a nice percentage out of what comes out of the ground.
No further questions. Please continue.
There's things we don't know. And what happened during the first open season in 2010? Why did it fail? There could be a number of reasons. SB 21 addressed tax rates. We don't know if the discussion was, you know, TransCanada, you've got a great project, and we know we want to turn our gas into money someday. But it's just not there yet. Our, you know, state taxes us, so we have, it's just not worth it. Or they said, well, the market's not that great. Or it may be that we're the ones with the gas. We'd kind of like to pick who we go into business yet with. So we don't have any of these facts. We don't know the producer's preference. I mean, they're all in the business. They know the business. They probably don't know that, perhaps they don't know the details as much as TransCanada has with the gas line through permafrost, because TransCanada is extensive of that, but they're not part of the process to determine who's going to represent the state in this project.
Don, were there any specific statutory requirements in AGEA that mandate that open season information stay confidential?
There were a number of confidentiality provisions in that, and it's a necessary thing. You don't want to publish why your open season failed in a way that it might jeopardize the next open season. Mm-hmm. So it's helpful that there be communication. I mean, the legislature would have known. I mean, if you look at when the contract was, or the license was issued in 2008, the open season ending on July 30th in 2010, and then not knowing. In the meantime, we're appropriating reimbursement expenditures for that period without really being able to know whether we're getting the bang we expected for the buck. I think my impression is that one of the reasons that HB4 was attractive is because there was more open communication, there were more open reporting requirements along the way, where there's feedback of just how you're doing. But information is going to be a problem. These are billion-dollar business decisions that people want to hold close to their vests. It's perfectly understandable. But at some point, you need to know enough information when you're trying to determine how much money to appropriate, what your money's going for, and what you can expect from it.
Fair enough.
The other thing about the open season and the license project. The license project, in my opinion, was the Alberta project. But TransCanada always said that they would solicit information to Valdez at the same time. Valdez was the focus for the LNG facility. So again, there was discussion about an LNG facility. It's a little different in different format than the Alaska LNG project. But there must have been... It must have come up in conversation, and the pros and cons. Those would be good things to know. Now, it's also important, which I don't think I mentioned, the difference between the AGEA project and the Alaska LNG project. There's a big difference. The AGEA project was to build a pipeline. So coming out when the gas came out of the gas treatment plant was ready, and there was... I don't think it was ever decided who was going to do the gas treatment plant. Somebody is going to do it. But it's mostly a pipeline project. And in the past, the producers have been reluctant to participate in a project that they couldn't own part of. And so that made a standalone pipeline project less attractive, plus other terms, common carriage. There were negatives there into the AGEA project that go away with the Alaska LNG project, where the producers are part ownership. And I talk about the producers because they're the ones that are going to decide whether gas comes out of the ground or not. Mm-hmm. AOGCC will say when and how much, but they're the ones that will decide whether it comes out at all. And they're going to have this project all the way to the LNG facility and to the tanker. So this is information we don't know. We don't know what the discussions have been, because there have been LNG discussions. Things we don't know. What's next?
Representative Sadler, you have a question?
Could you go back one slide? A question, too. Could you go back one slide? Yeah, great.
Yeah.
I
don't do PowerPoint. You know,
an honest man.
I'm my staff when it comes to this stuff. And I'm a Mac guy.
Push the button. Say TC's list of interest, open season, and direct exclusive. When you say what happened, you mean what happened, what was the interest expressed or not expressed?
Is that the changes identified that would make the AGEA project viable. I mean, it could have been things that maybe it's too small.
But when you say were changes identified at 2010 that might make it, what do you mean?
Well, there's two things. I mean, there was the formal open season in 2010, and there was the solicitation of interest in 2012. We don't know whether there were, so for example, conditional commitments made, you know, that if the tax rates on gas were reduced, you know, the fiscal certainty discussion, if there was fiscal certainty in whatever form that was, then we'd be there. We'd be signing our agreements and moving forward. We don't know if those were that discussions, or maybe they didn't like the way the project was formed, or maybe, you know, one of the issues on what is the AGEA project goes back to what the commitments were required. And there was an elaborate information request as part of a commitment if it was an LNG project. Both solicitations were required, whether it was by land or whether it was by sea with the LNG, they had to pretty much project what the cost would be to get the gas to market, because that's ultimately when you decide what you're going to get. And so the LNG project was as complete, the information required for an LNG project was as complete as the Overland project, which we know about. We know it goes to Alberta. We know there's a pipeline from Alberta. We knew who the parties were. We've never had that full information on the LNG project.
Okay. So the question you're asking, when you say, were changes identified that would make the AGEA project viable? First is, when you say the AGEA project, which route are you specifically referring to?
Well, both.
Either. Okay, good.
Yeah. The interest is that the overlap was solicitations also to Valdez and the Alaska LNG project.
So maybe better expressed, for changes identified that would make an AGEA project viable. Just to
because the open seasons and the solicitation of interest related to the AGEA project, the discussion would have been to the AGEA project. But along those same time, they would discuss the Valdez or LNG option, and that would be, why isn't the AGEA project viable? Because the LNG is a better option.
So trying to get to the question again, so either AGEA route, what we call the AGEA project, were changes identified, do you mean between 2010 and 2012? Or at any place during the negotiation?
Any time during those.
Were changes ever identified? Is that, that's what you mean?
Yeah, when I say change, I said what would have to change for us to sign up to ship gas? That's the kind of change I've taken out. It came up and said we're not ready to enter into a precedent agreement yet because these are our concerns.
So what you're really saying is you're not sure if there wasn't a viable deal presented, negotiated, but not committed to. Is that the question you're really asking?
Well, if it wasn't committed to, it wasn't a deal. But I think it was more the terms and conditions during that discussion of what it takes to make a gas project in Alaska work. What has to be there? And because there weren't commitments during the open season, something was missing. And it'd be nice to know what it was.
Okay. Your cryptic questions are cryptic.
So
you don't know.
But we don't know. But do we know we don't know them, or do we don't know we don't know them?
Stop.
That's all I have, really. So you've heard a lot of what I don't know, what I don't understand. But remember that the most control you have over this process is being members of the legislature that will write the laws and appropriate money to make anything happen.
Any other questions from committee? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In your opinion, with this memorandum of agreement and the HOA, does that provide us assurances that any other pipeline that we're doing does not kick in those commitments that it would be the clause that would make us pay triple damages?
I think we have to be careful. There are specific things that trigger it. I'm just trying to find. It's 4390, 440. Mm-hmm. Let's see if I can find my cheat sheet here. But trying to do it from memory. The AGEA inducements were to provide the services of an AGEA Act coordinator, which is the person that can help move things along. The royalty and tax incentives in AGEA were to induce producers to make a commitment during the first binding open season. Those, then the royalty benefits, similar to what we're talking about, being able when and how to take gas in kind rather than value. The tax incentive was that there was an exemption granted to a producer that committed during the first open season, that if the tax rates went up, that they had protection because there would be an exemption for that increase in tax. That was one of the ways the Constitution allows for exemptions, but it doesn't allow to contract it away. So that was one way to do it. And then the grant of state money, the reimbursement of costs. So the assurances were that we would ensure the licensee that the commitments that we were making to that licensee, we weren't going to also give to what was defined as a competing natural gas project, and that's a project that has more than half, 500 million cubic feet a day. And the 500 million cubic feet, the original idea, one of the concepts behind it, was that that was identified as the amount of gas that the state would need, but it was also related to the amount of gas that the AGEA project would need to be viable. It gives them enough gas to support a reasonable tariff, whereas if we took more than that, then it would tend to make the license project uneconomic. So you have to look at the Alaska LNG project and how the state's working with it. And I'm sure, I mean, there's a lot of really good lawyers in the Department of Law. And the governor's bills, I think, are, you know, from a drafting standpoint, what we do, they're well written, and I trust them to make sure that we're not approaching that point, particularly since the memorandum of understanding doesn't address the risk of providing incentives to a competing pipeline.
So
we have to be careful. I don't know, and I'm not. You know, that you have to look at the statute, and I don't know everything that's going on in the background. We can look at these agreements. We can see the products of discussions. But we don't know what's behind these or how they got there.
Thank you, because I'm reading what you sent us, and it's several pages of a lot of things that we have to think about, but it never comes around and says exactly what I want to hear.
I'm not going to say the state's likelihood of success in any litigation. The legislature and the lawyers up there will defend legislative contracts, but when it comes to representing the state's interests, that's the Department of Law. Now, I do refer you to the memorandum that was originally written to Representative Hawker that was part of the HB4 record, and that's in here, and it discusses the issue of assurances in 4390, 440, and what has to be in place. If, for example, TransCanada was out of compliance with the terms of the AGEA license, or they weren't in compliance with applicable state and federal law, they would not be eligible to get those treble damages. So that's one set of conditions that would have to be met. The other set is that we have provided benefits to a particular competing project. But it also has exclusions that if we lower the tax for everybody, that's not a benefit to a competing pipeline. If a lease agreement was renegotiated under existing law, that was all right. It's only when we provided particular incentives to somebody that would threaten the project that was contemplated under AGEA that we would have exposure.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Sutter?
Mr. Wallach, can you say, with your knowledge, is TransCanada in compliance with state, federal laws and conditions? Has TransCanada busted AGEA?
I think it's safe to assume they are.
They are.
But I don't know.
They are in compliance.
In compliance, right. I mean, they still, through their partnership or their working arrangement with Exxon, they still file monthly status or quarterly status reports now, I think, with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And the Alberta project is still alive and in the background, and maybe in the future sometime that might be the more economical option. I mean, things changed. In 2008, shale gas wasn't an issue. It looked like our market was going to be in the Midwest. And within a couple years, that's where most of the shale gas became available. And gas prices went up enough that it was worthwhile. Fracking's expensive. It's a lot more expensive than our fields, where pretty much they have sufficient pressure that, to produce without having to crack rock. That's one of the advantages Alaska has in the LNG market, is that our cost of production, where the gas is actually produced, could be more competitive against a fracking operation.
Okay, any further questions from committee?
Yeah, actually, on that same point, you said that this legislation would change the location of the point of production. And then
yeah, this one of the amendments in the bill. One of the things about taking custody of our gas is that there are additional costs with that. If we take our gas where it enters into the transmission lines from Prudhoe Bay or Point Thompson, after that, it goes through that pipe. It's going to go to what may be a combined gas processing and gas treatment facility. Gas processing takes the liquids out, so the gas that generally will go into the pipeline is methane. It's a single carbon and four hydrogens. you've heard about gas liquids. Those can be pulled out of the gas, and that would happen in a gas processing plant. And the gas treatment has to make the gas a pipeline quality. There's going to be other things besides hydrocarbons in there. There's going to be some sulfur. There's going to be carbon dioxide that has to be with. So the farther up the line where we get our gas, there may be more costs associated with actually transporting that gas. And the point of production is important because for tax purposes, that's going to be the point where the gross value is determined.
If you'll forgive me, so currently we take possession at the point of production at the top, at the wellhead, you're saying, and this legislation proposes to change it to where?
Maybe I can find it quickly. It's toward the end of HB 77 and 277 and some for gas not subject, the current law says gas not subject to or recovered by mechanical separation or run through a gas processing plant. The first point where the gas is accurately metered. So that's the traditional way. It comes off the lease, you measure it. That's how you know how much it is.
Okay.
It's changed to the furthest upstream of the first point where the gas is accurately metered, the inlet of any pipe transporting the gas to a gas treatment plant, or the inlet of any gas pipeline system transporting gas to market. So instead of one particular point, it establishes a new point of production relative to the gas treatment plant. And interesting enough, the gas treatment plant and gas processing plants are also redefined in this bill that kind of refer to the same. But
so cutting through chase there, so it's been changed to the furthest upstream point of what or what?
Furthest upstream of the first point where the gas is accurately measured, or the inlet of any pipeline transporting the gas to a gas treatment plant, or the inlet of any gas pipeline system transporting gas to market. So there's just there's more options. Now again, this doesn't apply to our royalty or where we take possession of the gas. That's something else you have to look at.
That's where the tax.
But this is where the tax, where the value is going to be determined at the point of production.
Okay, Representative.
Thank you. And in was 2021 or the end of 2021, these terms would apply to not just the North Slope, but all of Alaska, including the Kokanee sedimentary basin. Is that correct?
Right. I mean, you'd be hearing a lot more about the governor's bills, but basically what happens is right now, on and after January 1st, 2022, oil will be taxed at the rate it is now. The rate applicable to oil and gas will only apply to oil. The gas tax will be on gross value, and it'll be 10.5%. So if somebody doesn't have a lease that's modified, or if they do have a lease that's modified and they make the election to pay the tax as gas, then they will pay it. People that don't have a lease modified or make that election. They will continue to pay it in dollars, and it'll be 10.5% of the gross value at the point of production. Of course, this all changes the first version of the bill, so sure, there are things to look at.
So it is just something, Mr. Chairman, that we probably need to look at, because it's quite a change from current treatment of gas in Cook County.
Well, one other factor that relates to the amount of gas that there will be is that the state only gets royalty off of state land. And so those are the only leases that can be renegotiated, and those are the only leases that it looks like could pay the production taxes gas. But there's, of course, production off of land claims, gas reserves, oil and gas reserves, as well as federal oil and gas reserves. They're subject to tax, but not to royalty. So part of it.
Yeah, Representative Sather?
And Mr. I'm not sure if this is a question asked for you or for revenue sometime down the line, but...
Revenue.
So I'll toss it out there. Does the memorandum of understanding give us enough information that we will be able to calculate before we sign on the dotted line with the enabling legislation whether there's going to be residual value? As you said, the higher up the value chain, the processing we take our point of possession, the more expenses the state's liable for treatment, processing, shipment, et cetera, down the line. I'm concerned that we know before we do make commitments in legislation whether there's going to be residual value for the state, that it won't all be eaten up in transportation costs, et cetera, et cetera.
Of all the things that you've heard the last few weeks, I would say that what you heard from your consultants last Friday is probably the most significant of all of this. It all comes down to what the gas can be sold for, who's going to buy it, and what we have to do to get it to the buyer. Because if there's not a market, you know, think of the barley project. We could add a great distillery, but not much else there. I mean, we created a product without a market, and we have to be careful that we do everything we can, as soon as we can, to identify our markets and try and get ourselves in a position where we can deliver. Because, again, these are long-term contracts. The gas prices, they're in flux. You saw some of the graphs that were presented the other day. The older contracts were tied to oil value. The newer contracts, especially from some of the LNG exporters in the Gulf, are going to be tied to Henry Hub. And it's a competitive market. You looked at all those little bars on the graphs, all the different LNG suppliers. All their costs are different, and it may be that the approach is that somebody that's buying it is going to look what the cost of producing is and then base what they want to pay on that rather than being able to tie it to oil.
Fair enough. Well, Mr. Bullock, thank you very much for your presentation. I think it was a very productive meeting. This time we'll reserve the right to call you back at some point. But until then, we are adjourned until 1 o'clock on Wednesday.